You're listening to Visionaries by Wonder, a podcast where CEOs, founders, and leaders share their success stories with their host, Jeannie O, the founder of Wonder and an award-winning product strategy and UX design firm. We'll be exploring the world and connecting with inspiring individuals. Join us.
Welcome to Visionaries, the podcast where we explore the lives and ideas of exceptional individuals who have made significant contributions to their fields. I'm excited to introduce today's guest, Dr. Elizabeth Churchill, a senior director of UX at Google and a renowned leader in the field of human-computer interaction. Throughout her career, Elizabeth has built and led UX and research teams at some of the biggest tech companies in the world, including Google, eBay, Yahoo, and Fuji Xerox. She holds over 50 patents, co-edited and co-authored a total of 7 books, is a visiting professor at Imperial College's Dyson School of Design Engineering in London, and an advisory board member for the Pardee Rand Graduate School in Santa Monica and the Flickr Foundation. In recognition of her outstanding contributions to technology and executive leadership, Elizabeth has been named one of the top women leaders in UX over the last several years. She recently received a Lifetime Service Award from the Association of Computing Machinery's Special Interest Group on Human-Computer Interaction for her tireless effort to promote and extend the scholarship and practice of human-computer interaction and UX. I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to chat with Elizabeth today about her experiences, insights, and vision for the future of UX and human-computer interactions. So without further ado, let's dive in. Elizabeth, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Doing so well. Thank you, Jeannie. Thank you so much for having me here.
Yeah, so excited.
Very excited about your outreach. You're doing amazing work, and I'm delighted to share and talk with you, and your passion for sharing knowledge is one that I completely believe in. So thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So excited because you have such an impressive career spanning multiple top companies in tech. I'm curious, how did you get started in the field and what inspired you to pursue a career in UX?
So my first email address was before people really had email addresses, I have to admit. It was part of the education network in the UK. When I told my friends that I had an email address, they thought E stood for Elizabeth. That's how it was.
Elizabeth mail incoming.
Yes, exactly. So I've been around the field of technology and technology design and digital technology from very early in my career and very early in my learning journey. And so what got me into this field was understanding that computers are hard to use for a lot of people. And so, you know, the kinds of ways that we would interact with computers and build things, do studies and so forth, it was very hard to use. They were hard to use. Most of you won't remember, and this is actually before my time, but we used to have punch cards where, you know, you would actually have a physical object and you would stick it into something and then it would be interpreted. And then we got to the place where we all have a computer and then it just stops working. And you're wondering, why is it not working? And what is going on here? And you would talk to someone and they say, unplug it and then plug it back in. Or hit the following 5 keys. We still do this.
Yeah.
And I was really driven to try and understand how a computer works so that we can tell people how it works in ways that are understandable. Documentation, errors, what to do next, how to actually make the computer work again, why it's not working, just became a passion for me, an absolute passion.
So you're a true problem solver because you're looking at the issues of the computer and why it's not working and trying to fix that.
Yeah. Do you remember, you know, most people may not remember, but we used to have VCRs, the old VCRs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And nobody could ever work out exactly how to go back and forward and stop in exactly the right place and whether it was really working or not and why it didn't work. And then there were thermostats. Nobody could ever make a thermostat work as far as I could work out. you turn it up and the house was hot or it wasn't hot.
Yeah.
And then you turn it down because it was too hot. So that feedback loop of how a technology works and fits into your life to make your house warm or your, you know, recording go forward or back or stop or why did it not record? I thought I'd set it up. All of these things to me are fascinating because these are not people unable to work technology. It's technology unable to communicate to us what it needs, they need, what infrastructures need so that they work effectively. And of course, then we have these people who are experts who will learn and share with us. Back to your point about your love of that kind of learning and teaching. Everywhere I looked as I was developing my career, I thought, that's easy if you know what the mental model is and hard if you don't. So how do we get that mental model somewhere where everyone has access to it? Or we could have a community that will help you, you know, go along the path to answering the question. I like brokering between technologies and people and people and people.
So what are some of the common mistakes that you're seeing in terms of how humans are interacting with computers, whether it's an actual computer itself or AI?
I think one of the common mistakes is the assumption that the technology knows better than you. So as a person, you have an information need, you have an action need. And when the technology doesn't respond as you expect, you think it's a user error. It's your fault. But often it's that, you know, the technology is not responding to you in a way that is appropriate for you. And we have folks to talk to. We have online resources to help, but they're often not enough. So the biggest mistake people make is thinking that the technology understands them. And actually, the technology doesn't. The technology is very good. At getting a better sense of an aggregate big picture, and you're part of that picture. But when it comes to understanding you, you often want a human who can say, wait a minute, let me translate your question into something that is interpretable through manuals and expertise into what the technology needs, what the computer needs. So the biggest mistake, I think, is that people think that they are doing something wrong when actually technology is not reaching out to them and the resources may not be made available to them to answer the question clearly and quickly and efficiently.
So what you're saying, if I'm hearing correctly, is that there's not really when there's an error, it's almost like a liaison error. The humans are wanting the machines to produce something, and yet there's not that like middle ground of, well, does the machine even understand what you need? And we need to translate that in the form of a manual or a task or a process. One of the things that I was hearing with my network of friends that are using ChatGPT very often is they said that there's a future or there's a market for creating prompts. Because a lot of times we think, oh, wow, there's this amazing AI that's going to do all my work for us. But not necessarily. You have to feed it the right prompts for it to spit out what you need. And I think that's kind of like what you were alluding to.
Absolutely. Prompt engineering has become a term that we use.
Prompt engineering.
And the reality is we've always been doing prompt engineering with online resources of these kinds. So we think that search is a simple thing and you just type something in and you get a result. The reality is we've all been trained to understand how to put search terms in and what we're going to get back. We've been trained to understand whatever your application or interface is, whether you scroll down through 1, 10, 15 pages, scanning to try and browse what matches the way you think and what you want the best. There's a lot of research done looking at how search as a technical engagement is something we don't all understand. So things like has attachment, colon, whatever, you know, these are the tags that we can use when we know a lot about search. But even when we don't, We have spent a lot of time learning how to search. I'm going to give you another example, which is actually from work that my team and I did years ago on dating.
Oh, fun.
So you go onto a dating site and you think, oh, I'm just going to type in my requirements and things will come back. The reality is we groom what we look like. We put in certain keywords. We try it out a little bit and massage the information. We judge ourselves a little bit because we know that we're learning and we have learned what is more likely to get us a response. And it's not necessarily a response about the person. It's how does the algorithm work? How do I get matched to somebody? Is it location? Is it appearance? How do I turn myself into a kind of consumable, interpretable object for a platform infrastructure to partner or match me to somebody? So we are constantly always learning and shaping the platform while the platform shapes us. So this really is a dialogue. And to come back to your earlier question, you know, what happens when we don't get it right? Right? And it's not matching the system requirements, we adapt and the system adapts to us. So, you know, what is usable and what is not becomes part of a conversation. And one of the big things right now with the AI revolution and ChatGPT, etc., is that I can tell you why I reshaped myself for an outcome. ChatGPT can't tell me why it's recommending something and how certain it is or not in the result. So you could say to me, I say, Ginny, you know, should I date this person? And you would say, oh, I don't think this is you. What did you say? I don't think this is you. And I'd be like, you're right. I'm only like 50% sure that I'm talking about myself in the right way. And you, Ginny, you'd say, Elizabeth, I'm going to rewrite your profile. But I can't say, ChatGPT, how sure are you of that result? And, you know, I'm going to give you some feedback. And can you directly give me a response? Not going to happen.
Yeah. You're by the way, you're the second person that I've interviewed that talked about ChatGPT and dating. we had a guest named Dorothy Grant who's talking about how, like, I don't know, there's like 40% of men were using ChatGPT to write their Valentine's Day card this year, which is crazy. And now you're talking about writing your dating profile on ChatGPT, which, by the way, I tested it out and it's really good.
Good.
So it works.
I love it.
Yeah. So I'm curious, just from like what you've shared, how do you then apply that feedback loop into the work, into the process of your team currently?
So general feedback loop. So my team is set up to do understanding developer experience. That's what we're looking at right now. And understanding how developers use tools to create experiences that we all have. And so feedback is right in the moment of thinking about a particular innovation by going and talking to developers and saying, what do you need? What works for you? What tools are good for you? What is frustrating you? What's slowing you down? All the way through to who else would actually use the technology that is developed for developers to what do people need? And so feedback as part of the design process is all the way from thinking about the ideas through to thinking about any particular technology or documentation that is produced to looking in the long term how that changes the way people work. So feedback as a general principle is part of every process, practice, team that I've ever built. And it's looped in with all different kinds of research, from qualitative research to surveys, to quantitative research on looking at logs. Feedback is absolutely front and center all the time. Iterative, continual, getting input and thinking about how we can make the job easier for anybody, whether a developer expert or a consumer with a discretionary application that they're trying out.
So if I'm hearing correctly, you're trying to improve the experience of a developer so that they can then produce products for the consumer.
Yeah, so my current focus, I've worked in the consumer space in the past. My current focus is developers, and specifically developers who are thinking about building infrastructures like operating systems. What tools do they need? Mm. How do they talk to their community? How do they understand and use documentation effectively? How can we make their lives easier? And I have a particular belief, which is that if we can create tools for developers and designers that get them to their craft and creativity quickly without too much friction, mm. then we can include a lot more creative thinking around, for example, accessibility and inclusiveness in the tooling itself, which will then lead to the tools that are created, the products that are created, having a lot more inclusion baked in, accessibility being one. And by accessibility, I mean people who have, you know, concerns, issues, barriers to reading or hearing or whatever. If we have a much more inclusive process earlier by creating better tools and allowing designers and developers to be much more creative rather than experiencing themselves, I believe that we have a much more inclusive set of technologies that people can use.
So it's almost like a chain reaction of like, let's improve how developers are receiving feedback, and then developers and how they're working with designers, and then they then can create more inclusive design, which would then impact the consumer. So yeah. How...
I love that you said chain reaction. That's a really good way of putting it. Sorry, I interrupted
yeah,
you.
Yeah, no worries. Interrupt me anytime. And so how do you create that chain reaction in your everyday workspace? For you specifically, and also how can other companies model what you're doing?
So the first thing is to let everybody know that they are included in the conversation and that inclusion and low friction is number one priority. So if you're producing something, if you've got developers and designers, make sure that the tools they are using are easy to use, friction-free, and create an environment where accessibility and inclusion is a paramount number one for whatever it is you produce. Not just table stakes, not just, well, we'll do the bare minimum, but that this is a culture of production that asks about inclusion first. So do your tools work for you? Is the documentation good for you? Do we have a team that is diverse with multiple different voices to understand that the business goal is important, but the quality of the product or the platform as a long-standing thing is number one, top of mind for us. And you, as our developers and designers, are our number one customer and consumer as an organization. Because if we create that space, then what we can do is make sure that we create space and time mm-hmm. for anything we create, we produce, that goes out into the world for consumers to actually have the hooks in to get the feedback from them to understand that we are looking for a long-term big market. In a number of the tools that are used, there are hooks that are available to make sure that we have accessibility, say, thinking about screen readers as an early conversation, what is going to happen if somebody has issues around reading, sight, whatever? What are we going to do with that population? And if we take those boundaries as not boundaries, but as inspirations, then you actually make everything more accessible for everyone. So to answer your question more pragmatically, how do we do this? We have conversations always ongoing about inclusion and accessibility, technically, as well as in a team culture situation. we, back to your question, feedback, we think, who are we getting feedback from? Who are we not including? You know, one could say as, you know, what is our not intended market? But should that be an intended market? How do we get more people into the conversation? So in the design process, it's being aware and alert to what is missing as much as what is present, to being reflective about what is the constitution of the team, mm-hmm. what is the structure of how we do production, and where are we putting time?
So it sounds like, it sounds like trying to figure out like what has been the missing puzzle pieces, and then how do we incorporate that back into the not only the process, but the product itself. And I want to challenge you a little bit on that, because inclusivity has been a really big topic, especially in the last 5 to 10 years in tech and in the workspace. But at what point does it become too much, where it where the technology no longer becomes efficient, or the technology no longer provides the service that it was intended to, because we're being too inclusive? And how do you know where that threshold is? Where do you draw that line?
Well, I'm going to, you know, respond by inclusive with regard to what and efficient with regard to what. So is a team, is a team more efficient if you have people with all kinds of different accessibility needs, having the tools they need to shape what they're trying to achieve in the group context, right? So efficiency is a really interesting concept, because it's always efficient with regard to what? And it's always around how fast you do something or how productive you can be. And we've seen from, you know, the history of technology that we can make something more efficient and much faster, but then we change the nature of the job. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go back to some feminist literature on domestic tools. So, you know, the invention of the vacuum cleaner.
Love it.
The invention of the microwave. How did these things change the practice of what it meant to be in the home? Did it change efficiency? Sure. Now we are more efficient in terms of cleaning with a vacuum cleaner, but are we doing more work because everyone expects us to be cleaner? We have a microwave. So, we're efficient in terms of cooking, but does that mean that we don't cook as much? And then you have these reactions like the slow food moment, right? Where we're going back to eating is not about efficiency. It's actually about the cultural dynamics of eating together and building long-lasting relationships that are based in food and sharing and community. So all of these conversations around efficiency can also be around efficient for whom, with regard to what, and what else is shifting. So when we come to technologies and the design of technologies that are inclusive, what we could say is, well, we're taking a little bit more time and being inefficient by building tools that are accessible to people with different needs, could be visual, auditory, cognitive, or say, well, the history of technology design has been around accommodating a particular way of processing information and thinking about information, which is an abstraction and efficiency. Or we could say we are getting more voices in the room by having tools that more people can use, some of whom may say the microwave and fast eating is one thing, and the slow thing is eating slowly together and having something that lasts longer and is more meaningful.
I like the analogies, but I guess I'm thinking more like, so you gave an example earlier about creating a tool with screen readers, right? So if we're designing an app that and we're thinking about maybe 5% of the population that has a difficulty reading the screen, and we're creating design based on their accessibility needs, then wouldn't one argue that the 95% that it was actually intended for can now, it almost becomes unusable for them?
Well, the thing, you wouldn't have that 95% using the screen reader. The important history of some of this is that a lot of the technologies that we use right now that allow us to do interpretation, back to AI, that take information and digest it for us and present it back at us, many of the innovations were actually innovations that came about because we were addressing that 5%. I'm going to give you another example. This is another example from some of my experts, friends in accessibility. You know, on curb cuts, you know, a curb cut, when you're going to the side of the road and there's a curb.
Yes.
And then there's a little cut. So the curb cuts came about because people were involved in policy issues around making sure that folks with wheelchairs and so forth could actually go up and down. Mm. Right. And then it turned out that, oh, wait a minute, moms and dads with strollers were always bumping up and down. Sure, they had a less frictionful experience, but now they're like, oh, goodness, thank you. Thank you, the curb cut. People with shopping trolleys, people with laundry with trolleys. So you end up with something that started off as potentially for the 5% that being a benefit for potentially the 100%. I'm a woman who totters around on heels sometimes.
Yeah.
And the curb cuts, I'm like, okay, right. Rather than the big
Yeah. Same here.
Well, I think your question is a really good one, your provocation is absolutely excellent. And the way you phrased it is exactly the kind of conversation we need to have in the C-suites, which is, this is the 5%, but this is the 5% that has, you know, some fundamental humanity piece that will be served. And the fact that all of the 95 can work around this or don't care doesn't mean that that's not a valuable thing to bring back in, because you never know when that insight helps everybody. I've got another example for you. I'm a big fan of OXO, the brand for, you know, kitchen utensils.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, they have done a lot of work based in people who have low grip or, you know, have issues with mobility. But I don't have those issues, but I love the ergonomics of everything they produce, because I'm not here to do an ad, but because they took in mind something that is for people who have certain, you know, physical differences, maybe weaknesses. That's a terrible word to use. But then it's better for all of us. The ergonomics of the design turn out to be good for all of us. So I like to think about that in my world. So back to the why I work on designer and developer tooling. I'm like, if you can instill that tools matter in the most expert people doing the most deep technical work, that matters, and that will help them and the people that they mentor and the people who come after them, then I think we, to your term, chain reaction, we instill, we imbue in the very way of thinking about technology as well as developing technology, that chain reaction of what's to be included. And to your point, the productivity efficiency argument always is there. And bringing it into the conversation in this way, I think, is really critical. It hasn't been there.
Yeah. And what got me thinking when you were sharing the OXO example is what's happening in R&D. Like the intent could have been that, hey, we're creating a product for the 95%, which, you know, most of OXO's product is meant to be everyday kitchen use. But the idea of like, let's focus on what that 5% may need is almost creating a niche market within that space, right? With the ergonomics, as you said, and a great opportunity for anyone creating product to keep thinking about, okay, well, we're trying to create product A, but how can we make it even more niche, which is to think about that 5% in that inclusivity process. So kind of got my wheels thinking a little bit as you were saying that.
And I think it's about really great provocation, because when one thinks about this is the 5% that I'm addressing, what we need to do is deconstruct what that 5% is. So I'm going to give you a really silly example, right? You know, 5% of the world shares my favorite shoe brand with me, right?
What's your favorite shoe brand? You gotta share that.
This one you can definitely say. It's John Fluvog. Love the Fluvogs.
Nice.
Vancouver designer. Love the Fluvogs. Now, if we take apart why people like Fluvogs, like that's, it's not a census demographic. Why do people like Fluvogs? Well, it turns out style, very different, very recognizable. So social cachet, style, social cachet, connection. Anyone who loves Fluvogs knows that those are Fluvogs. You know? I've been stopped in airports where people say, you're wearing the Vogs. You know?
Yeah.
But also, there's a range of different products they have, which are comfortable, from the extremely high heels that, you know, we mentioned tottering around on, which I used to a lot, to very comfy flats, to spongy kind of rubber heels. So if we take that 5% apart, we start to see within that 5%, there's fashion, there's community, there's ergonomics and comfort, there's history and longevity, because this is a brand that you associate with over years. So for any 5% that we identify, we project upon them a reason why they are a unit.
Mm-hmm.
But if we look at accessibility and we look at people who have visual different needs, we go everything from legally blind through to unable to see contrast in light in certain ways, through to I'm using a different phone with, you know, a different contrast ratio. And that is the use experience, not the person experience. So in that 5% is such a rich area for us to just take even a quick look at.
Yeah.
And say, what are we actually saying? What are we projecting upon this 5% that we can overturn and wonder if our business strategy could actually appeal to, solve for, address, and service this need? So the Fluvog example is, wow, we're only 5%, but you know what? We are really high fashion. We are really and a bunch of people love our heels because they can run around on them. That's our brand. That's our identity. Where do we want to invest? And I think we want to do more of that in technology.
Yeah. And that just goes back to the chain reaction of like, let's be inclusive for the people creating the product. So therefore they can create the product. But then once that's out in the market, you're creating that community, which is such an important piece of growing a brand in today's market, right? As you said, like you most people might not recognize it, but when you know that they're wearing the same shoes, right? And I'm thinking like another example is like Aura rings and Whoop, the ones that like track your biometrics. I don't wear one, but I know that my friends who do, they're so religious with it. And they're like, it's a great way to meet other people. I was like, what? Yeah. And they said it's because, like, they'll just point out, like, hey, like, you know, I'm also tracking. I don't know how they start the conversation, but they'll just kind of point out, like, I also wear a Whoop or I have an Aura ring. Like, and they'll share their journey of biohacking and, like, measuring their biometrics and things like that. So it builds that community aspect when I guess you're developing for that 5%, because that's how you have the niche market, I suppose. It's kind of fascinating. Yes. Yeah.
But I've got a different example, which is around developer tooling. So I really believe in having open access tools and having people be able to come and do development work. One of the things we know from all of the research is that many of the developer communities are very gendered, and that women are not always feeling like they are included. From research, we know that people will, you know, pretend to be a male rather than a female in order to participate in open source developer communities. Now, that's the next thing is that we also know that the cognitive styles of people differ enormously. So you might be a visual thinker or an abstract thinker. You might want to come to development from a abstract, classical computer science, software engineering education. Or you might want to come to development from, I want to solve this problem. I want to know how to build a tool that will do this. So if we have these different styles of problem solving, of cognitive reasoning, and we create communities that are inclusive of multiple ways of thinking about developer and development, I think that we change the conversation that exists around who gets to contribute and who gets to be part of the conversation and who gets to be not excluded because they're the wrong gender or the wrong kind of thinker or the wrong kind of tool user. So I believe that if we understand that there are ways in which people feel included in the communities of production, whether you're the wrong gender or the right gender, whether you're the right kind of problem solver or a different kind of problem solver, whether the tools are the kinds of tools that you're used to or not, if we change that conversation, then I think we change the production of technology back to the catalyst and the chain of actions. So many of the tools that are used to create infrastructures right now are very specific to a particular kind of way of doing things.
Hmm. So I have a follow-up question regarding the fact that there's not enough female developers in the market. How do you then start cultivating those conversations where we are building a community around female developers, and how do we even just get more female developers in the market to begin with?
So there are lots of female developers in the market.
I mean, in ratio of what's existing.
In ratio. So I do think that we need to really deeply engage with what are the friction points that they're experiencing. I think we need to deeply engage with what the needs they have for career development. So some of the data that's coming out is that female developers do quite well when they're in the background, not getting confrontational, because they don't want to experience the sort of negative responses, and they don't know how you can engage with a hostile environment. The other thing that we've seen, and I'll say some more things about hostile environment in a second, but the other things we've seen is that female developers can get to a certain level, and then what happens as career structures need to grow, who gets heard, and what is the listening structure, and what is the performance structure, that it, we used to call it the glass ceiling, and then there's a great book, it calls it the labyrinth. It's like you're doing a jungle gym over here and here and here to try and get around. And how do you end up challenging what is traditionally female, projected upon female, judged as female, and how do you change that culture? We've got a long way to go, better place. But some of the work that's been done more recently that validates the experience of people who identify as female and are identified as female in the developer community is really helpful. So, for example, something was published recently which showed that when women make code review change suggestions, they are challenged more frequently, which, of course, means that you might reduce how much you actually make comments on. This is published. I can share it with you. I think it was in IEEE or ACM, not sure.
Wait, so you're saying when a woman is coding, they're getting challenged more, or the women are challenging the developers more?
When a woman does code reviews, the code review challenged more. Female code, women's code gets challenged more. So what you have is a challenge and then a retraction, and a challenge and a retraction. We're creating a system of response and share and who gets to speak and who doesn't.
Yeah.
That is very deep in the code, in the code production.
Does that,
anyway, I can show you.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. So does that actually make the code better because they are getting challenged more? The way that they're reviewing is getting challenged more. So wouldn't the quality of the code actually get better? Or do you think that actually has a negative implication because now they're afraid to speak up?
Latter. The latter. I mean, it's not my paper. It's not my research. I just read it recently and I can share it with you. And, you know, drill into it a little bit more, but you know, that I am challenging something. I am a code reviewer. Oh, you're reviewing my code review. Oh, you review my code. So it's, you know, it, do people get challenged more because you fit into a certain demographic? And then how do you feel that you are able to respond? Is that response something that is comfortable to you? Were you trained to do that? Do you feel privileged and entitled enough to push back? All of these things fit in to that kind of sociocultural way of showing up. And it skews towards women having a more frictionful time.
Yeah, that's a fascinating research. And I know we're coming up on time, but I'm curious if you can tell us a little bit more about what you had read and if there's any advice for organizations that may be facing this. I mean, they might not even have awareness that this is happening, but I guess one, advice for the women who might be facing this, and then two, just for organizations in general, how they can be a little bit more self-aware that this is happening in the market.
Well, I think number one, there's a lot of research out there around how the demographics of particular production groups lead to cultures of production. So the people you have and who gets to speak, that power dynamic will lead to a particular culture of production. Now, a culture of production also is about the deadlines you're under, the pressures you're under, etc. And if you want to have something which is robust and resilient, thinking culture first and understanding that you're including lots of voices and being aware that there are biases in who will and will not speak up is going to be number one for you. So if you're thinking that you've got a quick deadline, you need to get something out, but you want high quality, and you want resilience and robustness so that you're not constantly fixing your code base, understand what the team is, who the team is, and what pressure you're putting under, because high quality, resilient, not completely needing to be reframed all of the time for your long-term value proposition is going to be about that team that you build. The resilience rules reliability of the team. And that team needs to be feeling like everyone is heard. If you have your absolutely number one engineer, number one in terms of testing, code health, looking at tech debt, happens to be someone who is being silenced or quiet because they happen to be female or someone who's typically not going to push themselves forward, but they are the person who is going to help you with your tech debt, help you understand resilience testing and testing before you launch the next iteration or the first iteration. You need to know that that expert has to feel safe in the environment to challenge the people, maybe louder, faster.
Yeah.
The production. So look at your team, understand what robustness and resilience and expertise mean, and who may be being quiet over who may be being loud with regard to the goals that you're setting for your launches. And that understanding of the psychology of the team and the individuals and expertise is going to be the thing that's going to keep you going.
But how do you empower, let's say, that quietest engineer? Because the engineers are, you know, they have a different personality of their own, right? So how do you empower that quiet person to actually speak up and be heard and be part of these conversations when most of the time they don't even want to be part of the meeting?
Very, very, very good question. So communication shows up in many, many, many channels. One is the meeting. So the meeting, you might need to understand that the people who are the most technically adept at your long-term goal are the quietest, to your point, Ginny. So set up the meeting before where you're aiming everybody with the questions that will be asked and with who you want to speak and with how you're going to challenge and channel the people who are quieter. And say, I have heard that, and this is what I believe. I've asked Ginny to prepare for me some information. Thank you, Ginny. And I'm just going to throw it out there because I'm completely in alignment and agreement with this. Or it might be you've got a document and you go in as the leader and you comment on the points made by the quieter people and say, so thankful that you made this comment. Really appreciate it. Some of the louder people, you say, really appreciate your input at the meeting. Thank you. So using multiple channels and platforms, services, and sometimes as a leader, take the voice for the person who does not want to speak for themselves because of the social dynamic and elevate what they've said that you are in agreement with because you believe technically, socially, strategically, it's the right thing to say. But the burden isn't on them to be in the public eye, but you're acknowledging that they did it. Mm. And the people who like the public eye, you acknowledge them and you'll say, and thanks, we got your input the last meeting. That was great. So there's a lot of working out how, as a leader, your job is to work out how to have the right things heard in the right place for the best interests of whatever the outcome is that you're leading. And one has to be very aware of that because it's really easy when you're very busy to just be listening to the loudest people.
Yeah,
but you have to be scouting out who's quiet and quietly doing the work or who's quiet and will be my absolute tech lead, you know, strategic partner in 6 months because that person is just consistent, delivers, and knows what we're trying to do.
I love that technique. It's such a simple way to incorporate getting more voices heard just by, you know, having a quick 5-10 minute meeting with the quietest person to gather their input and then bringing that back into the larger meeting. It's such a simple thing, but I think that could definitely make a huge impact in the quality of the conversations that you have. And also it, you know, when you were saying it's the loudest, that's often the voice that gets heard. It's also kind of like social media, right? Like often the people who shout the loudest are actually not the ones that know best. Like if you look at research and studies and the best scientists, you don't see them on social media, but it's always the loudest people that like actually get heard. And people are like, oh my God, like, you know, this person and so-and-so, but yeah. You just have to be able to be conscious and distinguish like where you're actually getting your information from and whether that information is actually valuable to the bigger picture of what you're working towards.
Yeah. And it's about, you know, such a good point, Jenny, because a lot of people who are shouting on social media are not shouting because they deeply care about the discipline. They care about their identity, which is important to them, and how they're getting forward. Their whole life is influencer.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, a lot of people who are quietly in the background building the foundations, they don't want to influence except through their work.
Yeah.
Not through their selves.
Yeah.
There's this great book thing, which is around the, you know, delusion of innovation. And one of the points that they make in the book, which I fundamentally believe in, is that one of the biggest challenges for the technology industry, of any kind of technology, whether it's a sewer or a digital technology or an infrastructure platform, is the people who keep the lights on. It's maintenance. And the quiet engineers who do the end-to-end testing, the maintenance, these are the people, the groups who deserve the biggest praise and tend to be the quietest.
Yeah. But they're all also rarely ever celebrated.
Right. Right. Which is why, you know, in my teams, we're different. I work for a fantastic VP whose mantra is tech debt, testing, maintenance, infrastructure, which is why I like working for that person.
Mm.
Fundamentally my belief system too.
So you have over 200 articles published, 5 books co-edited and 2 co-authored, which is a tremendous impact on the field of UX design and research. So how do you stay up to date with like the latest development and trends in the field?
So I'm very blessed. I have a lot of amazing friends. I'm a social networker. I believe in networks. I have various folks who email me things. I love podcasts. There's a Tech News Update podcast that I listen to every day. Most mornings I get up and I have a look and see what's up in tech. I work at a company where I'm very blessed, where we have people aggregating information for us. And I'm just generally very nosy. And so I'm always poking people and saying, have you seen this thing? I don't really understand what it is. I saw this. I'm not much of a Twitterer, but I do follow. Just poke people who I know are on top of things. And the other thing I have found, especially, you know, as I sort of get later in career, I love teaching and I love working with students and my friends. Young'uns are the best way to find out what are the trends and what's going on, honestly, because they move from one thing to the next and they're motivated. So the big macro structural stuff, the news, the podcasts, my friends across the industry, the what is trending, students, friends, kids, input, information from all sides. Sitting next to people on the bus, I live in San Francisco and just south of the Mission, and I like to get the bus into work. And I just chat to people. What are you using? What are you trying? I'll see somebody using something. What is that?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'm a bit of a magpie. I just like to find information from all sources. So if you have recommendations, send them my way.
Oh, yeah. I have tons. It's when you were saying the bus ride, I was like, man, you're so lucky to live in San Francisco, because just by being there, you're you elevate the level of conversations that you have by just the people around you. I visit quite often, but yeah, it's like a little bubble of its own.
It is a bubble. It's going through its own troubles, bubble trouble. But it's still pretty, it's very vibrant. And next time you come up, you have to let me know because we're going to go out.
Yes, definitely will do. What questions have I not asked that you're like burning to like share, like information that you're burning to share with the audience?
Well, I think one of the things we talked about, email. So one of the things in
Elizabeth
email. Elizabeth Mail. Yes, Elizabeth Mail. So one of the things we chatted about a little bit was, you know, what do I think of the future? And we talked a bit about ChatGPT and the change in the way in which information is aggregated and reflected. And I am intrigued by the big conversations that are happening around large language models and the capability of AI beyond large language models that are the talk of the day, into how AI has started to increasingly do micro assists, little helps. Mm. So, you know, when you have an email suggestion, you put some names in, I say, Ginny, and then it comes to say, dear Ginny, durr. I love those because they're creating a space for that blank, you know, the blank sheet problem. They start something. So back to the efficiency question, it's super efficient for me to go, oh, you suggested, okay, great. And I just send it off like that. Oh, you suggested dear beautiful, which you actually said to one of my SVPs when we were in an early stage of evaluating the utility of something like this. Mm-hmm. But I'm a human that gets to go in and say, no, please don't write to my SVP and say dear beautiful, early prototype. and so I'm really excited about those places where we use the AI technologies to solve the blank sheet problem, to respond in a quick and productive way to a technology, Elizabeth Mail, that's a bit out of date, maybe, because it's been around a long time, but it still works and functions really well, but maybe needs some patches. I really love the explorations for incredibly creative people, designers, artists, to produce something using the materials that exist in the world and then go, but this is not my aesthetic. This is not what I want to say. A friend of mine who's an educator is turning the whole essay writing for students on its head and saying, here is how you use ChatGPT or Bard or whatever. Go at it. And then I am going to grade you on your critique of what was produced.
Ooh. Ooh, and that's really good.
So there's a provocateur, AI as provocateur, not as trusted tool. I was helping somebody write a letter of application for a job, and that person was completely stuck. So I literally just put in to Bard, letter of application for whatever, and got four different suggestions, including one which was, I think this was a ChatGPT one actually, which was, can you do this in the style of a Valley Girl? And, you know, it was this really kind of humorous moment, but the structure was right and the block ended. So I am really excited about the tools, and I'm more excited about how we teach everybody that the tools are to be questioned and to be invited to be transparent about how they came up with what they came up with, invited to an earlier conversation around, you know, how sure are you that this is accurate or not? There's also some real possibility for these tools, which is to ask the same question in different timeframes, in different languages to different parts of the world. A study was done years ago on Wikipedia that was absolutely superb. they put in a request around a particular topic. I can't remember what it was, but, you know, say Elvis Presley. And, you know, they looked at the different Wikipedia sites in different languages, and then they surfaced what is in common and what is different about the description of who is Elvis Presley. I'm literally making that up, but, you know, in different parts of the world. So here we have an opportunity to start to surface divergence and convergence and create critical debate around the governance of information and understanding and the governance of technologies and what sources they're using in order to share truth. So I'm a big optimist, and I am really excited about the opportunities that these tools offer, from cultural information, summarization, and critical inquiry, all the way through back to my everyday world. How do we support designers and developers with tools that allow them, for example, to do exploration of design spaces or code review that gives them more time to be creative, that allows us to take big bug databases and understand what are the bugs that come up over and over and over again, and how can we maybe automate solving those, finding syntactical errors quickly, understanding that a bug that is about, again, accessibility, we actually know how to solve that in other ways. Let's just help you figure out how to do it right now. So I think efficiency starts to become about creating the space of productivity, and it needs to have the critical engagement of people to know when you take the suggestion and when you don't. So I'm super excited about it.
Yeah, and I wish I could have stopped you in between certain points, because there's so many, I have so many follow-up questions for you. I mean, so for one, I want to know if that the person you were talking about with the job application, if they got the job.
They did.
They did. Okay. With the Valley Girl?
No. With the more serious one.
Oh,
but yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
The Valley Girl one was great, because it went something like, you know what, you know, dude, I can totally do this job.
I love it.
It's not written that totally do this job. Yeah. Like, you know, I'm totally all on it.
The second thing, this is just more of a bigger discussion, which is you're alluding to, like, well, what is, you know, what is the truth, right? Like, if I'm searching for a response or an answer from this part of the world, and somebody else might have a very different viewpoint based on their culture, you know, I don't even know what to formulate in terms of my question, but it's like everybody's got different truths, especially nowadays when there's so much information. So take, for instance, drinking coffee. There are certain parts of the world that might say drinking coffee is really good for your health. And then there's other people, other cultures, other experiences that would say drinking coffee every day is actually terrible for your health. And so how does someone find the underlying truth when there's just so much information being shared in the world and everybody has different cultural implication experiences and education around these topics?
So I think it's a great question. And so here's where I'm thinking of it as more of an aggregation. So if we think of search, as I put in a query and I get 40 pages, like we talked before, the aggregation unit is me. Now imagine that I put in a query and I'm like, you know, ChatGPT Bard, I'd like you to summarize all of the answers, you know, to this query and from in these languages from these countries. And then I get one page or one something. Or I get a beautiful visual representation of, you know, here are the top nouns, topics, things that I have found. And I'm going to come to some of the problems with all of this in a second, but what I then see is, I'm going to use a concrete example, which goes back to my travels of like decades ago. But if I'm looking at something like the Opium Wars, right, there's a British narrative around that.
Mm-hmm. Or any wars, yeah.
Chinese narrative around that. And then there's a dominant narrative through the history. So at the time and the history of how this has all played out around colonial trade routes, the deals that were done, incredibly complicated. And I remember when I first went to China going, oh, I didn't know. Now imagine a world in which I can just put in and say, there is no truth, but here are the dimensions of contradiction and of contestation. Here are the stories, and here's who was impacted and who got to tell the stories and who didn't.
Mm.
As a student, for me, I'm like, whoa, that would have taken me decades of scholarship. And now I have an inroad, not truth, but to understanding what questions I need to ask and what I might want to believe. And what is, back to your earlier comment, what is faith and religion around this?
Yeah.
What is truth? And where do I stand? So the critical rhetorical style of being able to aggregate that information and then just go, whoa. Because when I went to China, I remember being a naive young person who'd just been told a story and shocked and suddenly empathetic with a very different perspective that I had not had access to. So I do think these tools can allow us to go, oh, the story of these indigenous people in place X were never told to me. Oh, there's another language story that I couldn't understand because I couldn't access because it's in language whatever that is not predominant.
Yeah.
But it's available if you know where to look. Yeah. I did not know. I did not understand.
Yeah.
And I just think that's really powerful.
Oh, it's powerful and so dangerous, right? It's like, what's the information that we're feeding not just the youth, but the entire culture of a country? Like what story are we hiding? What's the version that we want to feed into this population? And that's the power and also the danger that the media has, which is really amazing to think about.
Yeah.
And not a lot of people question it. That's the unfortunate part. They receive the information and they receive it as that's the ultimate truth. And therefore that is now my belief. And that is where my opinions are formulated. And that's what I'm going to project back into the world. It's kind of scary.
You bring up a very good question, because the thing is that one has to have the motivation to go and say, what are the stories of the Opium War? What are the stories? You have to know that you want to go and ask those. And maybe that's the hard part, is having minds to knowing that multiple perspectives are good, because many of us just feel like the perspective I have is the only one.
Oh, yeah. I can have a whole conversation around this, because, you know, this whole journey for me started maybe like a couple years ago of literally questioning everything I've believed in. Like, why is this my real beliefs, or did someone bestow these beliefs and values over time as I grew up?
I think one needs to do that at regular intervals in one's life and to understand what the entrapments are. And when you're being projected upon, as opposed to breathing in and moving forward, I think it's really critically important. I mean, I'm at a different stage in my life than you are, but I am experiencing that myself right now. What is being projected upon me, and what is it that I want to take forward?
And
I think those are really important questions, many stages, many points in life. And, you know, part of our conversation today, for me, a lot of what I'm driving for right now is to inscribe values into technologies.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, the inscription of the curb cut is a way to change the way people move in space, which includes more people potentially. Like, how do we do that in a technical infrastructure? And that I'm in that questioning mode of, you know, well, I guess I'm successful, but I haven't changed that yet.
So what would you say is like the biggest truth that you're trying to debunk in your life, whether it's personal or for at work?
Oh, good question. The biggest truth I'm trying to debunk right now, which is a bit antithetical to what we're doing right now, is that I'm some kind of expert. You know, like people think I'm an expert, and I'm an always becoming. I'm a never there. And I embrace the naivete and the, oh, well, I've done a bunch of stuff and I know a bunch of stuff and I'm so passionate about a bunch of stuff, but I don't know. There's an always becoming. And, you know, in terms of the world that I work in, the truth that technology can solve the problem, solutionist thinking, is something that I'm, the problems may be recast in different ways, but solutionism and the computer science and engineering approach that is, here is the problem and I will solve it, typically picks up on the easiest thing you can solve. The really interesting issue is this big picture. You know, so actually targeting something on a map and giving you directions is technically infrastructurally hard, but that is what is called a complex problem. A complicated problem, not a complex problem. It's complicated, but the complex problem is, how does an urban infrastructure change when you redirect cars in multiple directions and through areas that, you know, may or may not be ready for being traversed? So, I don't know, the notion that you can take a really hard human problem, turn it into something soluble like this, and say you've solved it is curious to me. Because actually it's a perturbation that changes some other, you know, system that we need to work on. So it's always that bigger systems thinking.
It's like, how does like what you're working on then fit into the bigger picture of change? Almost. Yeah.
The biggest problem we have, honestly, right now, is the long-term sustainability.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, this venture capital firm, founded by a few people, including someone called Tom Chi, who's a friend of mine, is called At One Ventures. And At One is doing something really interesting, which is they will fund and support any initiative that has a potential that is really about sustainability and around the long-term, bringing multidisciplinary, multi-perspectival viewpoints onto the production of things that will regenerate and resustain. So At One Ventures, Ginny, I think you'll find this interesting. Tom is a good friend and very compelling, and the assembled team, amazing. And so I think there are some real opportunities for us not to think in this, like, solve the local problem and scale, this notion of and scale, but think about scale in a planetary way, which is around regeneration, not scale in an infrastructure way, which is innovation without maintenance.
Yeah, and that problem is going to become more and more inevitable and like up in our face as the years go by. That's for sure. Yeah. Okay, so my closing question to you, since you're working at Google, is what's the most embarrassing thing that you've Googled on the search bar that you feel comfortable sharing or uncomfortable sharing?
The most embarrassing thing for me personally was actually directions to drive from London to Newcastle, where my family is. I should know which roads to take.
Really? That's the most embarrassing? I feel like you would have had more.
Oh, no, in terms of embarrassing, in terms of, like, my family, like, you don't know how to drive home? Really? Really? other than that, what would be another embarrassing thing? Let me think about what would be embarrassing. I'm not easily embarrassed. That's a problem.
Thank you so much for today's conversation. I can talk more, but we've been talking for like an hour and a half. So we will wrap up. If anyone wants to find you or get in touch with you, what's the best way that they can reach you?
I just go through LinkedIn. My website is out of date. I think I last updated it at least 4 years ago, and now I don't have the password to figure out how to get back into it. I need to just change that whole thing. But just LinkedIn is easy. I check that fairly frequently.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth. Really appreciate your time and for you to share your experiences with our audience. Had a lot of fun in our conversation.
We hope you have enjoyed listening to our latest episode, and we would like to invite you to check out our other episodes for more thought-provoking discussions and inspiring stories. And don't forget to follow us on social media at Wander Studio and listen to a new episode every week.